I'm an executive director of Earth Economics, and he'll tell you more about that. He completed his graduate training in economics under Herman Daly at Louisiana State University. He's one of the world's foremost ecological economists. And Dave has taught in the training department of the World Bank, worked for Greenpeace International, specializing in trade and international finance. And he also worked for 2 years with the Rural Construction Movement, which is a Philippine nonprofit group dedicated to ecologically sound community-based development. And today he's going to talk about re-envisioning water jurisdictions and values in our Puget Sound watersheds. So, Dave.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Earth Economics is a small nonprofit organization. We do about half our work here in the Puget Sound area and a little bit of national work and some international work in Asia and Latin America. And one of our focuses is our ecosystem services, the benefits that people get from ecosystems, forests, watersheds, wetlands, etc. I'm going to talk about that a little bit today. But first, I wanted to start out with just a small note on the financial crisis and economic history, just a minute or two to start out with. And that brings us sort of our topic of how we re-envision institutions. Well, think about this for a minute. In the 1930s, when we had the Depression, and this current financial crisis is more similar to 1929 than it is to any recession that we've had since then. The banking sector is the core of our crisis. And in the 1930s, we had an economics which was basically microeconomics. We looked at markets, individual households, etc. There was no macroeconomics. It didn't exist. We didn't even have macroeconomic measures. So when the Depression hit, there was no GDP. It didn't exist. Simon Kuznets invented it in 1934. We didn't measure inflation. We didn't measure unemployment. 40 macroeconomic inflation measures didn't exist. We had no vision of the national economy. With the Depression, we had a whole new set of problems. Problems that, in fact, the economics of the day was incomplete, incorrect, and incapable of solving. We could not use 1929 economics to solve the Depression. John Maynard Keynes and the macroeconomists came around and said, let's try something new. And so macroeconomics was born. We got a new set of goals out of it. Goals like, let's pay attention to how much we produce out of the economy. We never cared about how much we produced out of the national economy, and we never measured it before. Let's pay attention to unemployment. Let's pay attention to inflation. New macroeconomic goals. And for those goals, we got new measures, like unemployment, GDP, and inflation, etc. With those, we also got new institutions. Social Security, a new Department of Agriculture, really, etc. And a whole suite of institutions that have been the basis for our economy today. And in fact, utilities really did kind of come out of the economics of the 1920s, where a public utility, and this is what is going to be the core of my talk, a public utility is organized, like Seattle Public Utilities, where you have a natural monopoly and you're providing a public good. So water is a public good. You can't have 20 pipes going to a house. So you're either going to have a private monopoly or a public monopoly. And in the United States, by and large, for water, we decided, let's have a public monopoly rather than a private monopoly. Well, what we're going to talk about today are a suite of benefits that are also public goods and that are underserved. So what happened since 1929 and the 30s? Well, between 1934 and 1944, we built a brand new economy. I mean, we completely reorganized. We got rid of a 19th century economy, and we built a 20th century economy. Wouldn't have been a good idea to invest in horses and wagons because we were shifting to automobiles and trucks. So investments in roads had a high rate of return. Today, reflect a little bit. In the 1920s, if we needed more salmon out of Puget Sound, we needed more boats and nets and people to go catch salmon. If we needed more timber, hey, you needed a few more saws, you need a few more lumberjacks up there and a few more railroads to get the timber out. Today, we're not short of boats and nets or chainsaws. We're short of natural capital. In fact, we have a tremendous abundance. Anyone with kids knows we've got way too many plastic toys in this world. We're great at producing certain things. We have no shortage anymore of plastic toys or asphalt. We have a shortage of natural capital. And this year, as every year in the Northwest, we have had record flooding. It's become an annual event, record flooding. So we are short of flood protection. And flood protection is something very different than plastic toys. You can't divide it up and set a market system to produce flood protection. Unfortunately, it's a public good. And so we need a different kind of institution to handle that. So anyway, thinking about this financial crisis, we need to build an economy that's a 21st century economy, not a 20th century economy. And if we try to rebuild a 20th century economy, we're likely to fail. And so we need to think very seriously about investment. And that also is another core of my discussion. So, very quickly, I'm going to talk about ecosystem services and what happens if you lose the benefits that ecosystems provide. One case is Louisiana. We're doing a study right now on hurricane protection. This is 1839, 1870, 1993, projected to 2020. Oops, you know. To today, from 1930, we've lost 1.2 million acres of land in the Mississippi Delta, because we channelized the Mississippi River, pushed all the sediment off the continental shelf, whereas for the many thousands of years, that sediment built an ever-expanding delta. Well, if you have this kind of land loss combined with climate change, well, we know one thing from climate change. Hurricanes are getting bigger. If Hurricanes Katrina, Rita, and Wilma had occurred in the 1970s, they would have been no more than Category 2 hurricanes, because the Gulf of Mexico was cooler, a lot cooler. And so when you all of a sudden have a hot Gulf of Mexico, these were just tropical storms, no big deal, until they hit the Gulf of Mexico, and then they blew up into the biggest hurricanes we've ever experienced, until Ike, another record setter. This is Hurricane Rita. So combine climate change, bigger hurricanes with wetland loss, and this is what you get, really. This is Ward 9 in one of the levees, the seawalls, which failed, and devastation, 1,400 people died. And so when we reflect now on this economy, so just to give you a little bit of background on that one more time, for every 2.5 miles of linear wetlands, you take 1 foot off the storm surge of a hurricane. Because wetlands, all the little leaves, hinder the hurricane from actually pulling up the storm surge and reduce the storm surge and its movement forward. So right along the path of Katrina, we lost 30 miles of coastline, if you can imagine. But still, with the wetlands that are left, the storm surge was reduced from 29 feet to 16 feet by the time it hit New Orleans. Had the levees been up to standard, you wouldn't have them fail. Unfortunately, they weren't up to standard, and the city was devastated. 1,400 people died. Huge catastrophe. $200 billion worth of damage because we lost an ecosystem service. There was no institution. Think about this. Hurricane protection is a very important public good. It's a very important service, just like drinking water, just like energy. But we have no institution to provide it. And so, we lost it. Well, as I say, maybe it's time, just like the 1930s, we reflected and we went, we need new economic goals, period. So, what are a new set of economic goals we might adopt? This is Earth Economics and basically ecological economics suggestions. One, if you don't have ecological sustainability, you can kind of forget it economically, because ecosystems are actually a foundation that the economy sits on. If you look at our landscape, Seattle sits within a set of ecosystems. And the same with New Orleans. You cannot have a viable economy in New Orleans or coastal Louisiana if you don't have healthy ecosystems. You don't have water, you don't have hurricane protection, etc. Second, we need to make decisions about rights and fairness, property rights, equity, etc. Third, economic progress, economic efficiency. And fourth, how do we set good governance? How do we have institutions that govern well, that are representative, and that actually do good resource management?
So those are a couple of questions we'll reflect on. Well, one, we need a little more education on these issues, and this is why we're releasing a couple of reports. This is going to come out in March, gaining ground. So what 45 academics in Louisiana and Earth Economics and a few other groups, we've said basically the solution there is to open up large diversions in the Mississippi River, control diversions, release sediment, rebuild
the delta of the Mississippi on a very large scale. Unless you're gaining land, you cannot have a viable economy. And that's a lesson for us in the Northwest. We've seen this record flooding here in the Northwest, and unless we have a good balance of natural capital and built capital, we're not going to have a healthy economy.
Well, we also produced this report looking at the valuation of ecosystem services in Puget Sound. You can find it on our website, and it's sort of the latest in valuation of ecosystem services. And if you look at what we're provided for flood protection, etc., just for the Puget Sound Basin, and only looking out of at 9 of 23 ecosystem services, we receive that the value of that capital asset of wetlands and shorelines, marine ecosystems, etc., is somewhere between $250 billion to about $2 trillion. If you can imagine what would happen to Seattle if we shaved off all the trees for the cedar and the tolt and the Green River watersheds, well, you know, Boeing would be washed away, and so would the port and a lot of houses. So we receive a lot of benefits without paying if ecosystems are healthy. And there are a few concepts I want to talk about with that. So what are ecosystem services and goods? Well, there are goods like food, fish, raw materials, timber, etc., genetic resources. Taxol, the cure for breast cancer, it was derived from the bark of the Pacific yew tree, our own yew tree right here, worth of probably hundreds of billions of dollars. Goods are things that you can drop on your foot. Water should also be there. There's another slide. So these are goods and services. They're easily marketable. They work for markets because, like an apple, if I take a bite of it or I have it, you can't have it. Whereas other ecosystem services don't function like that. Now, so we're pretty good at producing market goods and services and kind of handling them with markets. But there are other ecosystem services that don't fit well within that category and can't be measured simply by quantity of flow or board feet of timber, etc. Another category of ecosystem services are habitat, refugia, and nursery areas, say for salmon, migratory birds, etc. That has important value for species. Some things, you know, we can't really establish a dollar value for. These are sea slugs for Puget Sound. You know, how do they help people? Well, we can. Anyone who knows about them might appreciate them, but, you know, they're not going to have the kind of value that we get out of timber, etc. And then there's another suite of ecosystem services, and these we call kind of regulation services. Oxygen production, climate regulation, disturbance, so flooding and storm protection, water regulation, water supply should actually be on the good side, soil retention, nutrient regulation, waste treatment, etc. These are all very valuable and important ecosystem services.
So how valuable are these ecosystem services? Well, let's think about it for a moment. This is a video of primary production. Very important. So this is plant growth, and right now it's summer in the north, so you know it's higher and red in the north, and then it becomes winter and goes down. Plankton, of course, produce a huge amount, soak up CO2, produce a huge amount of benefit. And these terrestrial ecosystems and plankton are basically what produce oxygen. So, well, let's take a little experiment here. Let's be good economists and weigh two baskets of goods and services. Why don't we try that? And instead of looking at marginal value, I'm going to kind of measure absolute value. So marginal value is kind of what we pay for things. So I'm going to give you a choice of two things. You can have one ecosystem service and good, or you can have all your stuff, you know, whatever, you know, your car and your books and clothes. And in fact, we'll just throw in all of Bill Gates' stuff too. So you can either have one ecosystem service and good, or all of Bill Gates' stuff. And I'm going to ask you to vote. So an ecosystem service is photosynthesis, and the good is oxygen. So you can either have oxygen to breathe, or and not none of your stuff, and none of Bill Gates' stuff, or you can have all your stuff and all Bill Gates' stuff and no oxygen. Okay? How many vote for Bill Gates' stuff? No vote. Okay. How many vote for oxygen? Right, unanimous. Isn't that wonderful? We can reach unanimity. Well, that's a very interesting observation. Because right here, if you generalize that across the globe, what you just said was that there's more value in a free ecosystem service than global GDP. That's something.
That's really something. And think about the value that we get out of the well-functioning system for producing oxygen. One, it's produced in abundance, so the price is zero. What better price could we have than zero? We'd be worse off if we had to have a market for oxygen and had to pay for it. Now, of course, we might earn some money out of it. Maybe 2 billion people couldn't afford it, but, you know, etc. But I'll abbreviate this since I've got more to talk about. But anyway, think about it. It's produced in abundance, distributed equitably by our climate and ecosystem services. So we've got sustainability. We've got equitable distribution. It's produced at economic efficiency, which no market could match. So you could never produce oxygen for free. And it's produced reliably. So it would be unfortunate, you know, if we left oxygen production up to a utility or a private firm and we had a half-hour of oxygen blackout. You know, that would just be no fun. There are some economic benefits, and that is clearly an economic benefit that we get from ecosystems, and we don't want to mess with that system. We want it to work just fine. If the economy is going to wreck it, then guess what? We need to change the economy. And that's the way it was for ozone as well. The ozone layer provides a critical service protecting us from UV light. And if the economy is going to mess it up, well, it's a lot easier to change the economy than try and fix the ozone layer. And the same is true for climate change. Climate change is something over generations we're going to experience. It's easier to, even though it's difficult, it's far easier to phase out carbon, a carbon-based economy, and get it within a good carbon balance than to try and manipulate the atmosphere and climate so that we get a stable climate again. So again, this is a vast amount of value. Like the 1930s, where we had no measure of inflation or unemployment, we had no measure of this value. That's a big mistake. And so what's happened is we've seen scarcity move from market-produced goods and services to non-market goods and services, ecosystem services. So another set of ecosystem services are information services, aesthetic value, recreation, cultural value, spiritual value, science and education. These things are actually worth a lot too. Just like aesthetic value, if you look at just property value in Puget Sound and how much money people lay down for a house that has a view of Puget Sound or Mount Rainier, that's purely aesthetic value. They put a lot of money down. That's tens of billions of dollars right there. Now, it doesn't measure my value, because I don't have a house that has a view of Mount Rainier or Puget Sound. I still have aesthetic value, but the tens of billions doesn't measure that. So one of the issues about ecosystem services, unlike market goods and services, is that usually we measure a small amount of the total value. It's very difficult to measure the total value, but sometimes we can get at least measure part of it. So that was our study on Puget Sound also. It's a very partial measure. We know that there are about 15 ecosystem services we didn't even measure with that analysis. Another thing about ecosystem services, and I want you to think about this, natural systems. Seattle's a great example because our water is supplied. In 1906, the city council amazingly purchased this enormous watershed so that they could filter the water with trees. That saves Seattle $250 million. Most cities have to have a filtration plant. Seattle would have to have a $250 million filtration plant. Tacoma, $150 million if we had to filter our water. Well, it's filtered for free by the trees. And not only that, it's self-maintaining. So not only does it filter the water, but we don't have to rebuild a new filtration plant every 40 years. Because a critical difference between built capital and natural capital is built capital falls apart. These desks fall apart. The building needs maintenance. It's going to fall apart. Your car is not going to be driven by your great-great-great-grandchildren because it's going to fall apart. On the other hand, your grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren may well drink water still filtered by the forests in the Cedar River. And that's a very important difference. It's, again, better, greater economic efficiency with a natural system that is self-maintaining and produces goods and services than trying to replace it with systems that don't work. Well, a big piece of my talk, so value, we looked at the value, and I'm going to quickly go through this because of the Green River watershed.
Seattle down here, the Green River watershed, and up. And we valued 23 ecosystem services. I'll spare you all the numbers, etc., and give you the results. But if you have any questions, because there's a lot of detail, of course, to this, we found that just in the Green River, rather than just 9 ecosystem services, we looked at 23. We receive about $1.7 billion, somewhere between $1.7 billion and $6.3 billion in benefits every year. Now, this is like a house appraisal. This is not a perfect analysis. So we take kind of the lowest values in the academic literature and the highest values, and we figure, well, it's somewhere between there. Because we don't have the full suite of studies. We'd need about 150 studies in this watershed just to do this analysis. So we have to pull studies from other areas. So this is most sort of analogous to a house appraisal. We're getting a guess at the value. So if you can imagine a different table with 23 ecosystem services and each of those land cover types, then we can look at the benefits provided.
And I'll just, again, I'm giving you this in a nutshell because the main another main part of my talk is on a different subject here with the watershed utility.
But anyway, then if you capitalize that, so just like if you're paying on a house, your monthly payment, that's not the value of your house. That's a flow of benefits. You might consider it the value of you living there, your monthly payment. But you can use that monthly payment or that flow of benefits, just like the yearly annual benefits I showed, to calculate an asset value. So this is an asset value for that watershed, $45 to $167 billion if you have a 3.5 discount rate. Or is this zero discount rate? The number is much larger. Well, I won't go into discount rate discussion, but again, to say that it's reasonable to discount value from built capital because it falls apart. In fact, in the future, it's not going to produce benefits like your car in the future. So your car does depreciate, and we should discount that value. On the other hand, if it's a natural system, like think about the Seattle Public Utilities. In 1906, there were hardly any people here. And we provided very little water to those people. It was important to them. But today, that same watershed provides more water for more people. And so the economic benefits are far more vast than they were in 1906. If in 1906 they had discounted the value that we receive today, they probably wouldn't have been a justified, in fact, investment to even buy the watershed. But having foresight and a lack of education in economics, let's say, those city council members voted to buy the watershed. And it was a very, very good investment, in fact, for us and for those in the future.
So what's this concept of watershed utility?
If you take a look at what we have done in Washington State, and we're not unlike others, although we are a little bit bizarre in the number of tax districts we have, that's jurisdictions. What we've done is we went, oh my goodness, there's flooding. Oh, let's have a flood district. Okay, let's put a flood district where the flooding is, down at the bottom of the watershed, and all it can do is build levees. But wait a minute, the provisioning of flood protection isn't in that jurisdiction of the flood district. It's actually up in the upper watershed where water rains, forests slow it down, soaks into soil, dams pond it up, wetlands pond it up, soaks into the groundwater. That's where flood protection is actually provisioned. Yes, levees also provide some flood protection. But the geographic problem of a flood district is that if it's only sitting down at the bottom of the watershed, all it can do is build levees, even though it may be more efficient to make flood protection investments further up in the watershed. So we did a report for King County saying, basically, this is a crazy system. We've got 6 flood districts at the bottom of all our watersheds. They aren't working. We're having more flooding. We need investment further up in the watershed. So King County did unify all those flood districts, dissolved the 6 flood districts, made it countywide. A further suggestion of ours was that, in fact, billing should be where the benefits are received, down in the lower watershed, and you should reimburse those providing watershed benefits in the upper watershed for flood protection. Well, they didn't accept that yet, so we still have some work to do on that. But think about some other ecosystem services. When you talk about water, all of our water falls in a watershed,
and is either evapotranspired back into the air, goes down surface water, or goes into groundwater, and that's where we get our drinking water. That's one economic good. That's where we have to deal with storm water. For example, in the Green River watershed that I'll talk about in a moment, we have 15 stormwater districts. We had a flood district way down at the bottom. We have a utility which handles water there. We have over 150 tax districts just in the Green River watershed, you know, from parks to other things. And it's a big jumble of confusion because parks, which are actually recipients of stormwater and actually are able to filter more groundwater into the groundwater, they actually have to pay a stormwater fee just because the stormwater fees are based on land base. And so here you have parks that are actually taking stormwater off our hands and doing the right thing with it, filtering it into groundwater, but they have to pay a fee for stormwater. And those that are really generating a lot of stormwater, like giant parking lots, they're not paying their share for the stormwater fee. So we've got a system with the wrong incentives, the wrong boundaries, and we're not realizing that actually ecosystem services are provided as a basket of goods and services, not just as one thing. So the concept of a watershed utility, and we propose this to Seattle Public Utilities and to the Green River, 15 cities in the Green River watershed, and the Green River watershed, the 15 cities are interested in this idea. And that is that we merge flood protection, stormwater, and possibly drinking water, and salmon restoration all into one sort of utility. Because one thing we realized, if you do salmon restoration, like move a levee out, a levee setback, and we did two studies on levee setbacks, you're also providing salmon restoration. You're also increasing flood protection, because that means you can accommodate more water, you're going to have less damage to levees, you're actually going to save a huge amount in levee costs. It's cheaper to buy out properties and move the levee over than to every couple of years build new levees because they get demolished trying to constrain that river too much. So the idea of a watershed utility would be, let's get the boundary right on the provisioning and the servicing of water-related ecosystem services. And let's merge those things into one utility that can effectively invest. And in many cases, those investments are inevitably bound together. Just like salmon restoration and flood protection, you really can't separate those things. And why try? And the same with stormwater. We should be billing correctly on stormwater for those who are actually causing the most stormwater and reimbursing those who may accept stormwater. It's a much more efficient system. So that's sort of the concept of the utility. Also, this is very important for conflict resolution. So we looked at, if you look at flooding and a variety of other issues, we have a huge number of conflicts over the mismanagement of water in a lot of ways. And so one thing that we did, whoops, we blinked to the next subject here. So one thing we did was on one project in Ryan 9, the North Winds Weir, the suggestion was we need to, for salmon restoration, we have to put these off-channel sloughs in. And the Chamber of Commerce and others came back and went, $5 million project for salmon restoration? We kind of don't like this. What are we paying, $1,000 per salmon, Chinook salmon? Is this worth it? And then what we, Earth Economics, we did an analysis. We said, well, if you put off-channel sloughs in, what that also does is take floodwaters and kind of spreads it out a little bit, slows those waters down. It actually preserves your levees further down because instead of having a pipe that the water slams down and just, you know, slams into your levees, creates more flooding, you're widening out that floodway, so you get flood benefits. And then all of a sudden, the Port of Seattle and Boeing perked up and went, we get flood benefits out of a salmon? We love salmon restoration! And this Ryan 9, they have a committee of, if you can imagine, a steering committee that's up through Auburn, includes the city of Seattle, King County, Auburn, all the way up to Black Diamond. Steering committee of 70 people. Hard to make decisions that way. But we wrote this analysis, economic analysis. It was unanimously adopted. They all loved it. And I said, why, to the chairwoman, why was it so easily adopted? And she said, this made us think in a completely new way. It's the first time the Master Builders Association and, you know, the environmental groups got together and said, we both love this idea of looking at these benefits. So it's important to look at co-benefits. And remember, reflect, the utilities, the institutional structures we have in this nation,
were really created out of the 1930s. Utilities came out of the 1920s. Isn't it time we reflected again on how we might improve these institutions to improve our economy? It really is time for that. So
quickly, beyond compliance, we have another project with the Department of Ecology working with 5 paper mills, and we realized that if you kind of reduce the ecological footprint of some industries, then your Puget Sound's better off, water quality's better off. In fact, the companies are better off. So the big issue for paper mills and whether they're going to live or die is chip sourcing and energy costs and, of course, water quality and regulation. So with these 5 mills, from Wallula way out to Simpson in Tacoma, Wallula by Walla Walla, Simpson, and then on the coast, Grace Harbor Paper in Port Townsend, etc. We worked with these 5 paper mills both to improve their bottom line, so to improve their economics and to improve their environmental performance beyond compliance, so they're doing better than the state requires. And we've had a pretty good response. They like it because, of course, it's improving their bottom line. And we're trying to move their chip sourcing to also preserve ecosystem services. I won't go into this too far, but I wanted to say one more time, the core of our work is that currency is really the dollar, the language of investment. And that's why it's important to value ecosystem services. Because what we're talking about, the 1930s, if you look at 1934 to 1944, we had a tremendous shift in investment, both public and private, in the United States. A huge shift. And it built an economy of the 20th century. Today, we need another shift in investment. And our nation has never been, in fact, globally, humanity is sort of at an apex. We've never had so many people. We've never had so much wealth. We've never had so much technology. We've never understood these systems as well as we do today, even though we've got a lot of questions about climate change, etc. We've never had such access to actually implement change in an economy. So why aren't we doing it? Well, we do need to shift ecosystem. We need to shift incentives. And that's why investment is crucial. So if we look at the quality of life in Puget Sound, the Puget Sound Basin, we're going to invest about $100 billion in the next 10, 15, 20 years in the Puget Sound Basin. If we lay that $100 billion in both private investment and public investment to do what we've been doing in the last 50 years, we're going to have a bad quality of life. We cannot keep paving the way we've paved before. We cannot keep dumping our waste into Puget Sound the way we have before. We can't keep losing leisure time the way we've lost leisure time. Our citizens are working longer hours than ever before. That's crazy for a wealthy economy like we have. In fact, the number one request of people is to have more leisure time. That's what people say will make their quality of life better. That kind of works well with consuming a bit less and being a little lighter on the planet. So we need to think now, is more stuff going to make you give you a better life, quality of life? Or is sort of more leisure time, maybe less stuff? I found that in my life, I need less stuff. I don't need all that stuff. So we need to reflect on that, and we have to have the right incentives. In fact, today I'm going down at 3 o'clock to testify before the Senate, and I met with the Senate president last week. But, you know, it's crazy. We give the Centralia coal-fired power plant huge tax exemptions. We give all the refineries, oil refineries in this state, big tax exemptions. Why? Why are we doing that? British Petroleum, which owns ARCO, we give a huge tax exemption. Why are we giving tax exemptions to one of the most wealthiest companies in the world? And they'll never move that refinery. Refineries don't go bust. In the last 50 years, we've never lost a refinery in this state. They're not going to move away. Because refining, unlike aluminum, which you can move away and make aluminum elsewhere and bring in, that's why ARCO's gas is always cheaper than Exxon and Chevron and Shell. Because they have a refinery in Anacortes. So anyway, the essence of my presentation is get rid of these tax exemptions and continue the tax exemptions for a better economy on renewables, etc. And let's our tax system is something in this state, just in a nutshell too, that must be revamped. We have the most regressive tax system of the 50 states. Our poorest 20%, sorry about that,
our poorest 20% of our population pays more in taxes to pay for the state budget than any other state in the United States. Mississippi, you know, Arkansas, they're better. And so it's time, the last time we really revamped our taxes was in the 1930s. It's about time we did it again.
It's the only way we're going to have a sustainable thing. So funding mechanisms, finally, with a utility, you change things. In the Green River watershed, we're an aggressive group, Earth Economics. We'd like to try some really different things. What we've said is if it takes $300 million to restore salmon, let's put together a funding mechanism of $300 million. That's about $30 per parcel in the watershed. This is one of the wealthiest. So Seattle is up at the top there. This is a map of the watershed. The city of Seattle is up here. Here's Moray Island. Howard Hanson Dam, owned by the city of Tacoma, providing water for Renton and Tacoma, is here. This is all kind of green. Nobody lives up here. We've got some farming here. 650,000 people live here. If we actually did invest $300 million in this watershed, who are the beneficiaries? Those 650,000 people. They're the beneficiaries. And so what we've said is by also taking this set of investments, we're going to reduce flooding. Right now, Auburn and even South Center, et cetera, are under threat of going underwater if we have a really bad year again. We need to make some significant changes there. And so we proposed the watershed utility. We proposed a suite of funding mechanisms. One is actually the watershed utility, the furthest and wildest idea. And I have to say the mayors are all curious and interested in that idea, but think it's a little bit far out there. And then I'd say the more conservative view is just a straight tax on sales, or not sales, but property tax for watershed restoration. And some of our critics have said, oh, well, you know, nobody's going to vote for increase in taxes. But I think that's incorrect. You know, if you look at the bailout, you are all responsible for about $7,000 that went into the banking ethosphere. You know, did it really do us good? Did it save us? I don't know exactly. Certainly did fund a few bonuses, let's say, for CEOs. But every dollar invested in this watershed provides jobs and economic benefits in this watershed, actually. And so I think this is a very good investment, and I think we can move it forward. So we're going to do that. Then we have a couple other funding proposals, really wild ones. One in Ecuador for about $4 billion, which we're trying to, the Ecuadorian government, as a member of OPEC, proposed a 25-cent tax on all OPEC oil to create an environment fund. We supported this and developed the kind of economics for it. That would provide about $4 billion per year as an environmental fund. And to their credit, OPEC kind of went, this is a weird idea, but we'll consider it. And so it's under consideration right now. And that would preserve a big chunk of the Amazon, and also could look at some areas in Africa and Southeast Asia. So we've got about six or seven kind of crazy ideas for funding mechanisms. And finally, Earth Economics, we're involved in some very large modeling ideas. This is looking at a systems model and how you build that into ecosystem services. And from this, we can really get an idea of what kind of institutions, like a watershed utility, how you shape institutions so that they actually govern the size of the problem. So we need our solutions at the scale of the problem. If you don't have it at the right scale, you can't solve the problem. And that was our problem with flood jurisdictions that were too small. And finally, we have a National Science Foundation grant called Artificial Intelligence for Ecosystem Services. And this is looking at mapping ecosystem services. This is going to be the premier tool on ecosystem services, where in a Google map you can kind of circle it and it will pull data automatically. But I just want you to think about how each ecosystem service is mapped differently. The servicing, the beneficiaries, and the provisioning. So for example, carbon sequestration. Doesn't matter where in the world you sequester carbon, everybody in the world is a beneficiary to a tiny degree of that carbon sequestration and climate stability. But the provisioning is spatially explicit. There's a forest or something that is sequestering it, so it might be the upper watershed of the Green River. Whereas flood protection is different. Flood protection, the mapping of benefits is very explicit. It's at the lower end of the watershed,
Those are the beneficiaries. And the provisioning is in the upper end of the watershed. Again, water provisioning. And we've looked at the water maps for Seattle Public Utilities. So water, drinking water provisioning has an exact line. Sorry about that. An exact line at the Tolt River or Green River at the intake for our drinking water. So everything above that is provisioning and filtration of drinking water. And then the distribution shows the set of beneficiaries, which may be inside that watershed or outside that watershed. The Cedar River supplies water outside the Cedar River watershed. So when you start mapping these ecosystem services, then you get to some really interesting questions. For example, Seattle Public Utilities, we did an analysis for them. They had a 30-year asset management plan. And it included, just like most all asset management plans, their pipes, their facilities, their vehicles, all their built stuff. But it didn't include the watershed. And so we said, why don't you include the watershed as one of your assets? Because it's what actually provides water and filters the water. It's your most important asset. And to their credit, Seattle Public Utilities went, oh, that's kind of a good idea. Okay, write a white paper on that and let us take a look at it. And so we did. And then they went, well, this is a great idea. Okay, it's part of our asset management plan. And they slotted it right into their asset management plan. Made them feel good because their assets went way up, in fact. And they should go up because those are real assets. And also then they came back to us and said, well, now that you've shown us these assets and ecosystem services, we have another big problem. And how do you manage a watershed? Because if we cut a few places here or there, then we have we may increase snowpack, so we get more water. We may increase biodiversity, but we might get more rain on snow, which increases flooding. So then you really start measuring how do you manage where you gain in some ecosystem services and may lose in others. That's a real question we're interested in. So with that, I'll wrap up and just say that, you know, building the new economy is really, it's your job. It's hard to have it handed to you, but it is your job, and you're going to have to, whatever field you're in, public policy or forestry, business, you're going to have to do it. So anyway, any questions or discussion?
Questions?
Go ahead.
I understand the point of both the environment. You talk about the new economy, and I think it's a great idea to say. However, how do you reconcile both an economy that is right now, you know, that encourages to spend, and then how do you reconcile this with the environment then? Do you have any insight on that?
Well, it's very important.
Question.
How do you reconcile an economy needing to spend and with the environment? Yeah, and having so much stuff. Well, I think this is crucial, and this really comes back to us reflecting on our values. You know, if I had taken another boat and said, would you rather, we feel there are five capitals. I didn't have time to talk about that, but this is a great question to look at that. Built capital, like all our stuff. Natural capital, natural systems. Social capital, that's our relationships, our laws, how we get along, family, friends. Human capital, that's our education, our health, our etc. And skills, and financial capital. These five things are needed for a high quality of life and a good economy. How do we balance them? Well, let me ask you this. If you had your choice, let's take another quick vote. If you had your choice of all your friends and family or social capital or no social capital and all Bill Gates' stuff, no friends, no family, but a lot of stuff, how many would take Bill Gates' stuff? No friends. Okay, how many would have their friends and family? Well, that shows that's very important to us. And yet, we're losing our time with family and friends to acquire more stuff. Something's wrong there. And the same with our health. Would you rather have a brain and a heart that function or a brain and a heart that don't function, lack of human capital, and all Bill Gates' stuff? Well, I'm going to say you're going to vote for the brain and your heart well-functioning. And so, but financial capital is another piece that's really crucial. And the reason it's crucial is because it allocates investment, both for private and public. And I think what we need to do is really, as a people, as a nation, in the 1920s, the last time in the 30s, when we really reflected on the economy, we didn't have enough stuff. People were hungry in the United States. We didn't have enough. People didn't have, even the percentage of people that had indoor plumbing was very low in the United States. And so, you know, we needed more stuff. Now, we don't need more so much stuff. So I think the challenge is, how do we build an economy which is not geared only around producing more stuff? How do we build an economy now that produces leisure time in a greater amount for us? Because that's what people want. That's what people say will give them a higher quality of life. Yeah?
I mean, I see your point, but I think it's very polar. You put one versus, you put the streams. But at the same time, you're asking for like a change in behavior. And our doctrine of teaching students and teaching children is to, you know, be productive. I guess it's beautiful what you're telling, but at the same time, it's almost utopic.
Oh, I don't think so. I really don't think it's utopic. In fact, one thing that's impressive is how quickly we can change an economy and how quickly we can change behavior, in truth. I mean, already, we had a negative savings rate in this country for like 12 years. Negative! I mean, incredible. We were spending more than we were earning. Since September, it's totally changed. We have a positive savings rate now. Instantly. In like 2 months, we switched. And so I don't, you know, and you look at 1934 to 1944, that transition was just mind-boggling. The suites of laws, the change in, you know, highways, the changes in agriculture, etc. I think we're quite capable of dramatic change. I think we forget how capable we are of it. And in fact, I don't think we have much choice. Because another problem I didn't put up here was peak oil. And the fact is that oil prices will change our behavior. You know, oil, the supply curve of oil is vertical. We can't get much more than 84 million barrels a day out, and it's probably going to decline here. So in the summer when demand was high, what happens with the high demand? Well, prices go way up. It's over $4 a gallon. When demand declines with a vertical supply curve, well, supply goes way down. And I think that economics is going to force us into behavioral changes, kind of whether we like it or not, on a number of scales, and we can manage that better if we do the right investment. Anyway.
So I get what you're saying, and I totally agree with it. But I was just curious, if companies started allowing the leisure time, like, you know, the benefits of sick leave and all those sort of injuries, how do you think that would impact our drive? Would it increase bureaucracy?
Absolutely not. I think it's entirely the opposite as an economist. Oh, the question is, if we had more leisure time, more vacation, more sick leave, etc., would that create a mediocre economy and promote mediocrity? And the fact is that it doesn't. In fact, workers are more productive if they have more vacation. That's a proven sort of economic fact. And so so that's one thing. Workers are more productive, they're happier, etc. You have less conflicts in the workplace and at home, etc. And the same with sick leave. It actually isn't economically beneficial to have sick people working. It doesn't help you as a company. So we need to reflect on those issues. And we found in Europe that, you know, giving women more time with children when they're first born actually benefits the entire economy. Yes, a firm for a while loses out, but it actually gives greater loyalty to the firm, etc. So I think that we, in the U.S., we should just take a look at kind of economic analysis. In fact, and it will give us better advice there.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time, so thanks very much.